Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome to the Fourth Age Podcast. This is Jason coming to you once again, and I'm joined by Andrew. Andrew?
Hi, Jason. Good to hear from you.
And also with us is Jesse.
Great to be here.
And Virginia.
Hi, everybody. Great to be here.
Usually what we do is we start with some miscellaneous stuff, but this podcast is actually pretty special, so we're going to go right into the 13 Forsaken because we want to fit them all in. And everybody, the first person that we're going to talk about is Aghanor. So, who wants to talk about him first?
He is an interesting one.
I'll just give a physical description of him. The description is he's tall and he's as strong as Rand. He's harder than land with the face of a strong man in his prime. This is from the Eye of the World, chapter 51, and I do want to thank Encyclopedia Watt for giving the information that I'm reading from. So in Eye of the World, he's the dirty old guy with the gnarled face that gets killed pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think he's one of the most interesting ones in the sense that he was quite a researcher. He was basically the person responsible for the creation of the Trollocs and then, by extension, the Murdral and a few others like the Drakkar and the Golam and the Jumara and a few others. So I think that makes him kind of a unique person. He seemed to have been highly intelligent and very motivated to create and discover new types of plant life, crops, and ornamentals. But I guess that's part of what turned him over to the Dark One, was wanting to do things that he wasn't allowed to do, you know, in the normal course of events.
Now, one thing that I always get confused of, and I'm sure everybody else does, is Aghanor. Does he turn into Osengar or Arengar? I believe it's Osengar, right?
I believe it's Osengar, yeah. And then also Dashiva, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. Osengar is Dashiva as an Ashaman. Jesse, what do you think of Aghanor, Dashiva, and the dirty old man?
Aghanor is one of the Forsaken I'd have to admit I probably know the least about. I personally did not even realize that he was Osengar for quite a ways into it. I probably didn't even figure that one out on my own. I'm sure that's something I picked up either in a podcast or on one of the forums or something like that. But he's an interesting character, but he's definitely not one of my favorites.
I think it's kind of interesting. It makes it very specific in when you read about him that he was not a governor. He wasn't, you know, a foot soldier or anything. He, you know, literally wasn't a field scientist. He was a lab geneticist. One of the interesting things that he has the reputation he does as a Forsaken, because during the War of the Power, it was estimated that he, like, took away, I think it was 10,000 men, women, and children every day for use in the various things that ended up being the Trollocs and the Murdral and the weapons for the Murdral. And as they said, in the last 5 years of the War of the Shadow, that number doubled daily. And I just kind of, you know, he had this weird power to be able to say, okay, yes, 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 no, yes, yes, no. And it was just, you know, and suddenly thousands of people were carted off to become, you know, fodder for his next wave of experiments.
I think there's a parallel between Aghanor and, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, the Nazi regime. It kind of seems like Robert Jordan wants to draw a parallel between him and the, you know, the high-ranking Nazi officials who unfortunately did experiments on people, and what they thought at the time was for the good of the race, but ended up being just terrible and evil, evil things. That's kind of like a parallel, and that kind of sums up what Agenor was in the Age of Legends, is he was just the most evil person. He had no sympathy. He just used lives for testing.
Yeah, that's pretty much the definition of evil in my book. He just had absolutely no compunction about doing anything as long as it furthered his purposes. To sort of jump ahead a little bit, one of the things that always baffles me is when he's masquerading all that time as Dashiva, constantly talking to himself, mumbling and talking to himself in the old tongue. And I can't believe that Rand never picked up on the fact. Rand even thinks to himself how Dashiva, a simple farmer, speaks and writes the old tongue fluently. I thought, how did he never catch up with that? But what is he saying? Why is he talking to himself? I mean, it just seems so odd to me that he would be doing that nonstop. It seems like it would almost be a distraction from trying to hold his disguise of the Mask of Mirrors or whatever he was using.
I have always kind of thought that that was just his sheer boredom with the position that he was in. And that always made me wonder if he had ended up in that position maybe through no choice of his own, but it was more of an assignment. And I don't know what really led him to masquerade as Dashiva. But I've always kind of thought that he just seemed like somebody who was bored and kind of going, wow, this is not my job.
But you also have to realize that it wasn't like Mask of Mirrors. At that point, no one had met Corlan Dashiva. He was an unknown who Agenor's soul got shunted into. So, I mean, no one would have known him to look at him anyway. I do think he was put there on purpose because he kind of was on one of those last chance kind of policies. Having screwed up in the eye of the world, they were like, okay, well, I brought you back to life. So don't screw up this time.
That always surprises me that the Dark One would need, you know, to resurrect all these people. I mean, surely he has enough followers that he could have promoted somebody new to take the place of one of these ones that's messed up. But he's constantly giving these guys second chances. You know, Lanfear got a second chance, and so did Mogedion, and obviously Osengar and Arengar. It's kind of funny in a way. I mean, yeah, you wouldn't think that the so-called Great Lord would be so forgiving in a way. Not my picture of him.
I think it speaks, and this was a thought I had just a few seconds ago, is I think the reason maybe why Rand didn't notice that Dashiva was, you know, a Forsaken was that's one of the big, you know, heroic faults of what Rand is. Not to pull too much literary terms into it, but one of Rand's faults is he's ultimately trusting. He will trust anyone until they prove otherwise, and that's one of the big faults that Rand has.
You also have to factor in that Rand knows Matt, and Matt and he grew up together, and out of nowhere, you know, Matt starts speaking the old tongue fluently, seemingly without realizing it. You know, it's one of those things that coupled with the madness that inflicts men because of the taint, you know, maybe somewhere along the line, Dashiva, you know, picked up the old tongue somehow. You know, it might just be a weird, you know, derangement, and it might be some product of the, you know, past lives he's lived emerging, like happened with Matt before they went to Shadar Logoth.
That's really true. I tend to keep forgetting, because he's so powerful and forward-thinking in so many ways, that Rand is still basically a farm boy, and he's had so many strange and bizarre things happen to him. He does have a tendency to just accept things that happen. And as you say, to trust people until they actually do betray him. He's always telling himself how hard he is and how he's not going to trust anybody. But basically, he's very open and honest and expects other people to be that way first. So he's going to constantly be let down by a lot of these guys. I mean, look at how he thinks that Elsa is one of the most faithful to him of the Aes Sedai that swore to him after trying to kidnap him, because she's so fervent and she's the dark friend among them. It's like, hello.
Okay, so moving on. Does anyone have any last thoughts on him?
I was actually just going to say, do we think that Agenor has actually been working behind the scenes to create any new shadow spawn before he was killed at the cleansing of Saidin?
I don't think so, because the cleansing came pretty quick. I think that was sort of a surprise to the Forsaken, and as well as the Dark One. It wasn't anything that was planned. Rand did a good job with the cleansing of kind of keeping it secret until it came about. So I think that came about before he would have any opportunity to do anything other than his assignment, as you put it, Virginia, which kind of seems like what it is, and Jesse as well.
Okay.
So moving on, we will go to, for me, one of the Chosen that I always get him mixed up with is Her, or Balthamel, who actually turns out to be Arengar, who also is masquerading as Halima. So there's kind of one character with three names. So what are your thoughts on this one person?
Well, I kind of picked up a little bit pulling out of the white book for one of those little quirky fake news segments in an earlier podcast when talking about Baltimore. He was the sleaziest teacher I think you will ever find anywhere in the Age of Legends. And then, like, you know, talking about how he would coerce students into meeting him in dive bars, essentially. And he was this lech beyond even what Aghanor was capable of. You know, he literally lived for carnal pleasures, and the wheel ground him down so badly when he was sealed off in the boar that he couldn't even use his own face when he first appears in that. I mean, his tongue had been ground down to where he couldn't even speak. He just kind of had this leather mask covering his entire head, and it just, I always thought that was hideously creepy.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. It was pretty creepy, and he's kind of creepy, actually, as Halima in a lot of ways, too. She's kind of an interesting study. I think it's remarkable how, to me, the change that overcame Balthamel after becoming a woman, basically.
I was just going to say that I think that out of all of the Forsaken that are still active in the world and still influencing events, the position that Halima has achieved next to Wayne, or that position, I think it frightens me the most. It's the one that I am always, as I read those sections, the most worried that something horrible is going to happen, because she's in this, you know, for a long time while they're on in the camps and on the move, she's sleeping in her tent. She is sharing a tent with one of the Forsaken. And that is, I think, one of the best suspense things in the book, of just you are so worried about this character and what's going to happen there.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I can't imagine that we've seen the last of her, and I'm sure that she's laid some sort of strings on Egwene to be able to manipulate her in the future. It is kind of scary to think that she's had all this power over her just in that short time, with totally without her knowledge. And I can't believe she's another one that's way too trusting in a lot of ways, that she didn't pick up on that. A lot of other people had suspicions about her for various different reasons. She just didn't feel right to, I think it was Chesa, her maid, who didn't think that there was something not right about her. She made her feel unclean, sort of.
Yeah, I also wonder if Egwene is going to figure out, now that she has been captive in the tower, that her headaches have mysteriously disappeared. Any headaches she's having now are probably the result of being drugged with forkroot. But for the most part, she's not having those same headaches that it used to require Halima's massages to get rid of. And I'm waiting for her to figure that out and realize that maybe there was something else that was causing them. And it wasn't just, you know, working too much or dreaming too much and not getting enough sleep or anything like that.
Well, she's so smart that I can't believe that she hasn't figured that out already, either she or Siwan. It amazing to me that that whole situation lasted as long as it did. And I thought it was pretty clever of Halima to insert herself into that particular position. And the other thing that kind of astonishes me, and I've spoken about this before, is that Halima is still capable of channeling Sidene rather than Sidar. And that calls into question a lot of things about the nature of the One Power, which probably are beyond the scope of this Forsaken podcast. But if it's an inherited genetic trait, I don't understand how, when the Dark One puts one of their souls into a different body, that the other sort of power goes with it. That's amazing to me. But there it is.
I think right along with that is, and we've kind of touched on this already, is the adaptability. I mean, while she still channels Sidene, she also has adapted her mental thinking relatively quickly to start thinking as a woman as opposed to a man. And I mean, I know she still has some flashes back to being a man, but I mean, a lot of her thinking transferred over into how to act as this, you know, luxurious, you know, really luscious woman. And it's, you know, once again, I kind of find that a little creepy because, you know, she's giving Egwene these massages and it's kind of like this weird pseudo-sensual thing. And you've got to kind of wonder, you know, even if you don't want to, you know, what that's like inside Halima's head.
Yeah, I thought that was very creepy, and she's starting to move on to, you know, full body massages. We haven't tried that yet. And I'm like, oh, I'm going, Egwene, come on, don't do it. It's kind of frightening that she's allowed herself to fall so much into somebody's power that way. It's a real weakness in what I perceive as otherwise a very strong and capable character. The other thing that, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of monopolizing the conversation here, but the other thing that I'm curious about with Balthamel in the guise of Halima is that she's just so desperate to get Loghain gentled or killed after he's restored to the One Power, and I'm wondering what the motive behind that might be. I'm sure that we haven't seen the end of that either.
That's a really good point that you make. I hadn't really put that, paid, I guess, enough attention to that to really see it, but I think that you're right. There's definitely probably a reason why she wants that, because, as you know, as we all know from Min's viewing, there's something very incredible in Loghain's future.
Well, she says that Loghain has power and glory such as few men will know ahead of him, but I've always maintained that I think that's possible, that Loghain has been turned by the 13-13 combination, and that the power and glory could just as easily come from serving the Dark One, and he may be one of the channelers or one of the people close to Rand that has been turned. Because I can't believe that Robert Jordan put in so many references to channelers being susceptible to being turned by 13 Dreadlords channeling through 13 Murdro to not have had it happen to anybody yet, and we're already in the last book.
Does anybody have any last thoughts?
I did have one little point that just tacks on to what Virginia says. I mean, the simplest explanation for why she would want Loghain gentled or dead is because gentled or dead, he can't say, oh, look, that woman can channel Sidene. But at the same time, I could also see where if he has been turned, that it's possible that Balthamel knows that, hey, here's another new powerful male channeler who's working for the Dark One. That puts me in a very tentative position of getting the axe.
Oh, that's a good point. I actually hadn't thought of that. I like that idea. The other thing that always kind of surprised me about Halima was that she spent all this time dragging this body out in the woods to dispose of it, and it seems to me it would have been a lot simpler for her to just open a small gateway inside of her tent and shove the body into it without any platform, let it fall endlessly into nothingness. I can't imagine why she would have gone to so much trouble. It seems like with the power there would be so many other ways to dispose of a body, even without balefiring.
Wasn't the point of that, though, that she wanted the body to be found?
She buried it in the snow.
Which body are you referring to?
It was either Salome or Mary.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the Aes Sedai in the camp that start going missing, and I've always suspected Halima had to do with that, the ones in the camp after they've traveled to outside of Tarvalon.
Yeah, absolutely. She was trying to get rid of all the ones that could make the Quendiar because she figured out what Egwene was going to do with the chain, I guess.
Well, there was also the point that wasn't she purposefully trying to make them believe that there was a man channeling somewhere within the camp and that, and so she was just randomly butchering people with the One Power?
I don't think she was randomly butchering them. She was going for the Aes Sedai that seemed to have the most talent at doing Quendiar. It was Anaya and
Kristen?
Something like that. I can't remember her name now. But, you know, she was going over those particular ones because they were trying to figure out what they had in common, and other than being of the Blue Aja, they didn't really have anything else in common except that they were on Egwene's short list of people that could turn iron to Quendiar really quickly. That's how come she ended up using Bode Coffin.
Well, not using Bode Coffin.
Yeah, not using Bode Coffin and using Liana.
What we're going to move into now, and I promise to everybody that's listening right now, don't groan, don't perk your ears, but we're going to talk briefly about Asmodian. Just to fill everybody in, Asmodian will be, in case anyone hasn't heard or hasn't read, but the death of Asmodian will be explained who did it in the final book. Brandon Sanderson, who is kind enough to offer that information to us by the request of Robert Jordan, will be putting it into the last book. So at least we'll get some kind of answer as to who actually did it. I have my own opinion, so what does everybody else think? Just quickly.
Grendel.
I'd have to say either Grendel or Avienda.
Yeah, I'm pretty much sticking with Grendel. I had a few other sides, and I figured, you know what? No, she does kind of have the best cover for the entire thing. What interests me about Asmodian is that whereas you have scientists and governors and all sorts of people who you could easily see becoming part of this, you know, large force of evil channelers who is out, you know, to serve the Dark One, Asmodian really doesn't fit the bill because he was just really jealous of everybody else around him. He was a composer. He works these amazing bits of music, these amazing compositions, and he's actually pretty well known in the Age of Legends, just apparently not quite well known enough, and he felt just slighted enough that he's going to turn against the world and, you know, mutilate the people that he felt most slighted by, you know, chopping off the hands of, you know, painters that, you know, he thought just, you know, were surpassing his work by their work, or, you know, sewing people's lips together and things like that. And it was really kind of weird. And at the same time, it was one of those things where I thought he was probably most easily reconverted to the light, if such a thing is truly possible.
I was just going to say that I think that Asmodian always struck me as more of a crazed artist than really a truly evil individual, as some of the Forsaken are obviously very, very evil, just seemingly in their souls and by their own nature. He always kind of struck me as being more of the just kind of dissatisfied, you know, malcontent, kind of off his rocker, like just crazy artist type, as opposed to the really truly evil.
Yeah, you know, I'd have to agree with that, although I have to think that his crimes were pretty horrific, even though they were not on such a large scale as most of the other Forsaken. But mutilating, you know, competing artists to me was pretty heinous. I don't know if I could, you know, the problem is that Asmodian was really kind of likable, and there's just nothing to say that evil people are not going to be people that might not be perfectly likable. They don't have to be, you know, mwahaha all the time. They just have the evil in their souls that they allow to come out, and Asmodian was one of those. And I can understand. I feel like Moraine did. I understand why Rand did what he did. He had to do it. But boy, it's scary to allow somebody that evil that close to you for that long.
It's at least not as bad as when you keep them that close and you don't know who they are. That was the one kind of concession that Rand had made, was at least he knew who he was. And it's being that he knew who he was and he wasn't in a position to obviously reveal Asmodian's identity to everybody else. He, you know, at that had an opportunity there to really keep a close eye on him. And, you know, I actually thinking about when Asmodian is killed and then later in the battle with Ravin brought back to life through Rand killing Ravin with Balefire, it really does seem that Asmodian had genuinely returned to the light. And as he, you know, questions his rebirth in that manner, it actually kind of makes me sad that he died. He could have potentially been a positive influence. I don't say it's not that possible that he wouldn't have just turned back at the very first opportunity he got, but he could have been a positive influence in Rand's fight against the Dark One.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. His connection to the Dark One was severed, in a way, you know, by Rand when he cut the wires or all the things that happened to him. He cut his connection to the Dark Lord. So I think that bad influence must have been fading from him over time. But one of the reasons that I thought Avienda might be one of the ones that was possibly Asmodian's killer was that I know Moraine understood, she said in her letter that she understood why Rand had to do what he had to do, but she wasn't approving of it. And I wondered if maybe one of the last things that Moraine might have done was to put Avienda up to killing him at the first opportunity. And she did have the opportunity to follow him out when he left her and Matt, Rand and Matt and all those together.
I think one of my favorite things about Asmodee, and I'll keep this kind of short, was just he was always in the background, and he would like be playing an instrument, and you know he would just kind of maybe pause and comment on what was going on in the conversation, or he'd just switch the music to fit the mood and as it changed, and it kind of speaks to his brilliance. But I always liked that because for a while I had a role-playing character who did the exact same thing. And it was just so amazing because it was one of those things where the person would just be playing along and then suddenly it'd be like, you know, the lyrics of the song would change just enough to get the hint across that, hey guys, maybe you should be paying attention to this instead of that. And it was just one of those things that he kind of did, and I was always struck that that was really neat that he actually, one of the effects that he had and that and how he accomplished it.
To me, Asmodian is one of the most brilliant characters that Robert Jordan has come up with because he has so many levels and so many depths. And you can imagine that this is actually a real person, like a real person that actually lived because he has his faults. He turned to evil, but yet there is some sort of realism to what Asmodian is.
Yeah, he's the kind of person you could actually imagine knowing. He seems more grounded in reality than a lot of the other Forsaken do. You could see why Rand actually developed a little bit of rapport with him at one point in time. And it was obviously a good thing for Rand to have somebody to teach him, but I think he taught him a lot of things besides just how to use the power. I think it was a good insight into the nature of how people turn from, hopefully he was fairly good, to serving the Dark One.
We will move on to Belal. His real name is Dorum Cham. He's the only really description that that's given for him is he's tall with close-cropped white hair. Out of the Forsaken, he's one of, I'm not sure if any of the other Forsaken are blade masters, but he is the ultimate blade master of the Forsaken. So what are your thoughts on Belal?
I was a little sad that they cut through Belal as quickly as they did. He is also one of the first Forsaken to fall in the series, when you really think about it. It was interesting. I tried at one point to break down the etymology of their names with the little amount of old tongue that we actually have available to us. And it was really interesting because they called him the Netweaver, and it didn't seem to connect at all. But he apparently was kind of like a personal advocate or a lawyer in the Age of Legends. So it was kind of one of those weird things that he had just a splay of talents that was really interesting.
Just to finish up about the description of Belal, what happens is Moraine ends up balefiring him because he's trying to goad Rand sort of into taking Kalindor. And I agree with Andrew that he's one of the more interesting characters that don't really get as much attention as I would like to see, because he is kind of sort of like like a lawyer that you would see in Law and Order that just that kicks some butt, you know, with his sword. He didn't get as much attention as I would like.
Yeah, especially considering that the country that he took to rule was Tyr. You know, he just disappears from the book so quickly, we really don't get much of a feel for what he did while he was ruling Tyr as the High Lord Saemon.
Well, that's true. I mean, the other thing that you get is that he has been manipulating people into following various others around. I can't remember exactly how it was. I mean, I have always had the distinct impression that he was one of those people who tried to steer Doman towards getting himself killed, as we mentioned in an earlier podcast.
It's very probable that those were his minions that kept trying to trick him into, you know, taking incriminating evidence into Carrion and allowing himself to be captured by the agents of Galdrian.
I've just been reviewing on Encyclopedia Watt just some of the information about him, and one of the interesting things that I've just noticed is that, and I don't specifically remember this, but I have only read Knife of Dreams, I think, twice, as opposed to the number of times I've read everything else, so that there is a meeting of the Forsaken at which Erengar notices that there are 11 chairs at the meeting, and is wondering why Moradin has placed out 11 chairs when Asmodian, Belal, Ravin, and Samael are all dead. And I just wondered if that might be a hint of foreshadowing that obviously we know, or it has been up until this point, that anybody killed by Balefire does not get to return. But what if that might be changing as the pattern collapses and Tarmon Gaidon is approaching?
That's a really interesting thought, as reality itself seems to be unraveling. Who knows what the Dark One can touch now that he hasn't been able to do? Because previously he said when someone had been Balefire that even he could not step outside of time. But maybe that's changing. It's kind of a scary thought when you think about it. Like, they need more problems. They have plenty to be going on with, don't you think?
All right, so moving on. We will speak about Demandred, who, to be quite honest, out of 13 Forsaken, he's probably my favorite one, only because nobody knows what he's up to. So what are your thoughts about him?
I kind of, when you get the first sense of Demandred, what they tell you about him, he always seems like a day late and a dollar short. Like, he's always trying to overcompensate for being just slightly not as good as Luce Theron. I mean, amazing in everything that he could possibly do. Most people would be like, wow, this guy's totally awesome. And yet he just can't get over the fact that someone's just a tiny bit better than him, or was born just a day before him, or something like that. And I mean, he just, you know, whereas they mentioned that, you know, Belal was known as the envious, really, when you think about it, Demandred is, you know, even more envious for less reason. And it was just kind of really interesting that he just has this sort of driving need to just kind of get out there and try to do everything better than absolutely everyone, but especially Luce Theron.
Belal is like, he's kind of like, and I agree, he's envious of Luce Theron, but I think Demandred is, he moves from envious to obsessed.
He seems to me to be one of the most shallow of all the Forsaken, and maybe among the most petty. I mean, he's described as having captured two entire cities and fed every prisoner, man, woman, and child, to the Trollocs just because they'd slighted him some point in time in the past. He doesn't seem to have, I mean, he plans and he's scheming, but he doesn't seem to have the long view. Just from the conversations that he has with the others, he seems to get upset and impatient. You know, he doesn't have the depth and the patience that the others do to lay these intricate schemes and plans. At least that's the impression that I get from him.
Does anybody have any theories about where he is hiding out or what he's doing?
Yes, I do have a theory about what Demandred is doing. And if you don't want to be spoiled, because I'm 99.9% positive that this is what's happening, Demandred is teaching Taim, and he is the one who is behind how evil Taim has become, and coaching him as kind of like a third party, you know, kind of out of the scene, but he's still invisible, he's still there. So I think Demandred is teaching Taim, the Ashaman, to, because there's two factions, you know, so I think Taim is the one that's with Demandred, and Demandred's teaching him, and Demandred is the one that's leading the Ashaman to the last battle.
Yeah, I have to say I share that theory as well. It seems pretty obvious to me, and I think that's what Samael was referring to when he said that events to the south have Demandred's mark all over them. I think he was referring to Andor and the Black Tower.
See, my theory goes a little bit further to suggest that is it possible that Taim is Demandred?
No. Robert Jordan has said that Taim is not Demandred.
He said he's not a character that we've been introduced to yet. So he's probably masquerading as someone, but we just don't know who yet.
Yeah, I do agree with Jason's theory. I do think that the patron behind Taim is more than likely Demandred. I also kind of had a fleeting pseudo-crazy theory, because they say, you know, events in the South, and no one's really mentioned in the series itself, although it's mentioned in the Big White Book, that there is an entire continental island to the south, which is the island of Mad Men. And, you know, it's always one of those things that I kind of wondered, are they ever going to make a play into the series or not? And I could just see Demandred, you know, somehow maybe working with all of these just crazed, you know, homicidal channeling men that have existed on this island since the breaking of the world.
I believe that Robert Jordan said in an interview that the Isle of Mad Men was not going to figure in to the last battle or the events surrounding it. I couldn't tell you when he said it, but I'm pretty sure I read that someplace.
Fair enough.
Don't we have enough going on?
Yeah, we don't really need a whole bunch of Mad Men just, you know, just deciding to return home like the Sean Chen or something like that. But getting back to Taim, if it has been obviously stated by Robert Jordan, then, you know, that would explain that. I would maybe suggest then that something I'm just thinking of right now, if Demandred is not posing as Taim, I'm wondering then if it wouldn't be possible that Demandred has actually turned Taim, and that Taim might be one of those that has been turned against his will to the shadow.
I could agree with that for certain.
Obviously, Taim is something more than what Taim is. He's obviously not part of the good side. He's obviously on the Dark Lord side, because he says, at the end of the first book, and I'm not going to repeat it because everybody knows what he says, the Great Lord of the Dark, but Taim is something more than what Taim appears to be. And you're right, he could be one of the people that were turned by the 13 Forsaken, because when we're first introduced to Taim as a person, if anybody remembers him coming out into the hall and meeting Rand, he really did not seem as if he was shady in any way, if you will.
And he also seemed to pick up some of the terminology quite a bit. He refers to the so-called Aiel, and those were some of the reasons that I thought he might have been, Demandred might have been Taim as well. But since that's been debunked, I have to go with that. He must have just picked it up, but he picked up referring to gateways as traveling, and Rand always referred to it as gateways. He never referred to it as traveling when he taught him. I have always had Taim picked as probably one of the ones that has been turned by the 1313. And also, he may be one of the ones that the 11 chairs at the Forsaken meeting, I think he might be one of the new Forsaken, because if some of them have been taken out permanently by Balefire or whatever, I think there need to be 13 Forsaken for some reason. It's sort of a mystical number, and I'm sure it didn't come up from nothing, but I think that Taim will be one of the new, he's certainly now one of the new Dreadlords, in my opinion, and will be one of the Forsaken to take the place of one of the ones that was Balefired.
Yeah, if he's not Demandred, then absolutely he's at least a Dreadlord, if not an up-and-coming Forsaken, and I think that would make a lot of sense. I would definitely agree with that, you know, one of those chairs could be essentially for him. One of the things, though, that has always, I guess, leaned me in the direction of thinking that he was Demandred, though, is the way that Luz Theron goes completely nuts inside Rand's head every time he's around him. And since Luz Theron doesn't have the typical ability to just sense the presence of a dark friend or somebody who, you know, means him harm. Obviously, we've talked about how trusting Rand is. It always seemed that there was some, like, greater recognition going on there.
I totally agree with that. But, you know, when I read the books, the last time I read the books, I think it was my fourth or fifth time or something, but the last time I read the books, I kept that in mind when I was reading about him, and it kind of seems like Luz Theron doesn't specifically aim his I want to kill you against him. He kind of aims it towards more the Ashaman rather than specifically, Demandred. Demandred as, as being Taim. But he does say it a lot when Taim is around, but he says, I've got to kill them. He doesn't specifically say, I have to kill him, but it's more about the Ashaman rather than Taim himself.
But there was one point where Lutheran is thinking inside Rand's head that, and this again was one of the things that led me to believe that Demandred might be masquerading as Taim, but he sees him and then he thinks about, I believe it was Demandred and Salmael, and he's reflecting on, when did I ever give you one fingernail less than your due? I believe it's when he gives him the pins. And Lutheran is just ranting away in his head about how the more honors that he bestowed on them, the more envious and angry they became.
I never noticed that part, but I'm going to have to look into that a little bit more. Thanks, Virginia.
Well, that was one of the big convincers to me, but since Jordan said that Demandred wasn't Taim, that has to be the way it is. But boy, he had me convinced.
Okay, then we will move on to secretly my favorite Forsaken, who is Grendel.
I think Grendel's one of the most interesting of the Forsaken. I think she's probably, next to Lanfear, she's probably one of my favorites. She's very devious, and she has a lot of layers. She has probably more personality levels than most of the Forsaken. I think that's what attracts me to her.
Grendel definitely seems to be the Forsaken who has the most fun. She's not just evil just for the pure sake of being evil. She does seem to just have the most enjoyment out of it. And I think that's kind of why she's almost kind of a fun evil character.
Yeah, apart from kidnapping all those people for her pets, you could actually kind of like her.
I don't know. I think it's also really interesting that she went from one extreme to the other in her life. Before she turned to the shadow, she was not only this, person who was really brilliant at working with the mind, but she had this, need for everything to be amazingly simple. She was, one of those people who eats, mayo on white bread. And, it's like, delish. To make a horrible, horrible 80s cartoon reference. But then she also, when she turned to the shadow, suddenly it was hedonism all the way.
She kind of has that repressed, Catholic schoolgirl mentality of, probably had extremely strict parents and an extremely just conservative attitude until, and we don't know necessarily exactly what really flipped her. Maybe it is in the white book. I don't remember specifically.
Dedicated ascetic turns into girls gone wild. It is pretty strange.
To put it physically to her, she's blonde, beautiful, of course. She's busty, which Robert Jordan has a fancy of describing in his book. She has red gold hair, I think is what they say. She in the Age of Legends, she's actually a psychologist. I don't know if everybody realizes that, but she is. She's actually a really intelligent, psychologist, person of the mind. She understands how the mind works. She indulges in the fact that she knows so much that she takes advantage of that same fact. In the Age of Legends, she was a psychologist, and then she turns out to be a very narcissistic type person. That's why she's my favorite, because she goes from one extreme to being a psychologist, someone that gets into that field because they genuinely want to help people, because that's kind of what you get into that to do. But then she turns out just to be one of the most sadistic Forsaken, probably at the top three or four of the people that are the most evil of the Forsaken.
Well, she does use people as furniture.
And pets. She has all her pets, cavorting in the pool for her amusement. There was also that one scene where she's, I believe it's when Salmael comes to visit her, and she's on the dais overlooking the pools with all of her little pets cavorting and the acrobats and everything. And there's one scene where there's the little sad, shabby man sitting against a pillar. And the description very much matches the the man that Matt sees in Ebedar outside of Jaqim Carradine's palace, and so I think it was probably Noel Charon, but I've never figured out why.
So, final thoughts on Grendel. Anybody have anything specific they want to say?
I think it was an interesting note that particularly when they're talking about the pets, even for her drastic change, there is still a weird sense of order that she keeps, because everyone there, you know, has had their hidden talents brought out. Everyone is in their place and serving their proper function. And I think that's a really neat distinction for someone who is so about the physical, and who has made this leap over in that she still is intimately connected with not only how people think, but the workings of just the mind in general, that she is able to manipulate many things, and that, you know, she just takes pleasure out of everything, even if it's forging signatures, you know, which she does, making or signing orders from the king of the Ardamon.
Ardamon, I believe she sent them to Rodal Iteralda.
I mean, she really, really enjoys the concept of letting the Lord of Chaos rule, and it's great.
I like to play the World of Warcraft, or WoW, as you will. I like Grendel so much that I named one of my characters after her, so that's my final thought.
That's pretty cool. I just wonder what you think she's up to now.
That's a very good question.
But no answer.
I had a kind of thought that she was one of those people who had gotten the call to stop fooling around and follow Moradin. So I thought she was one of those people who was kind of kowtowed into doing whatever Moradin's going to bring out for us in the last book.
Jesse, what do you think about Grin?
I would agree with Andrew. I think she is being kind of in a position right now of having to be a little subservient to Moradin. I also think, though, that, you know, with what I know about all of the Forsaken at this point, I really would have picked Grendel as one I would have predicted to become Nibliz. So I don't necessarily think that position is a permanent one, and I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't have some kind of plan that she's at least going to try to make come to fruition to, unseat him and take over that position for herself. I can't picture that, because she's not bound in the same way as Mogcadian or Syndane with the, Corsova, that she's not going to be trying to scheme her way out of being subservient to Moradin or any man, for that matter.
No, in fact, she specifically reflects that even though she has to obey Moradin now, she didn't see anything in the Dark Lord's or the Dark One's command to give up some of her other little plots, you know, like the business with Ardamon and some of the other things that she had going. So she's obviously still going to work all that as long as she can.
And now that we're on a high note about Moradin, let's talk about Ishamael. First thoughts.
Well, what's with the creepy flames in the mouth and eyes? I never really was comfortable with that. That's so weird. I mean, what is that? Is that an illusion? What?
I've always kind of thought that was a Mask of Mirrors kind of intimidation tactic.
It certainly works.
Well, it's that, I think, combined with Ishmael being amazingly insane, and they make no break about it, being not completely sealed in the boar with the rest of the Forsaken did not do good things for his mind. And he was already out there to begin with.
Yeah, I was going to say.
From that very first moment we meet him, he already has this grand thought of how the universe works, already worked out. And he kind of tells Lúthien before the end, it's like, look how it actually works. Guess what? We've been doing this over and over and over and over and over, and we're going to keep doing it over and over. You know how I know? I stepped outside of the pattern. And that's the creepier thing, is that when you get into what's said about him, he seems to imply that he has stepped outside of the pattern, which we don't even know anyone outside of the Creator or the Dark One who can do that, you know, and saw the truth of the universe. And of course, there's literary stuff to back, or literary evidence to back up the idea that the true truth of the universe is accompanied by madness.
He reminds me of, I'm sure everybody can relate to that one person in high school that you know that's just, he doesn't fit in with anybody, and he's just, everybody kind of thinks he's just a crazy lunatic, you know. That's what I think of when I think of Ishmael / Moradin.
Well, he definitely has an overinflated view of his own importance. I think that partly goes with the madness. He seems to want to take credit for almost everything. And it's repeatedly referred to by the other Forsaken that he seems to have a hard time distinguishing between himself and the Dark One.
Yeah, in fact, in the first book, I think he kind of believes he might be the Dark One.
Well, he certainly implies it to Rand and everybody else.
That was something that the first time through the series really confused me, was it took a while of reading to really understand the difference between the Forsaken and the Dark One and Ishmael and the whole situation. Once you get it, it's like, okay, it makes perfect sense now. But initially, that was very confusing for me. And I wondered at one point whether or not that was just a, you know, if this had not been designed to be however many books long series that it will eventually end up being, it almost seems as though it was just he really is I'm terrible at literary words, but the protagonist or the antagonist or whichever one, he is the opposite of Rand's hero character.
Yeah, I've had that thought myself. I really think that, I've mentioned this before, that obviously the book, he couldn't have known when he wrote the first manuscript that it was going to be so widely accepted and go on for 10, 11, 12 more books. So I think that there was originally a little bit different plot line, and it was probably, perhaps if I may, imperfectly redesigned when they realized that there was going to be the potential for a sequel. So some of the original plot threads don't make as much sense as all the other ones later on do. And that's my opinion, anyway. And, of course, the famous last words, it's going to be a trilogy.
Yeah, when Robert Jordan started the series, it was in his thoughts to be, you know, three, maybe four books. But the depth of what he wrote, I think it kind of surprised him. It kind of surprised everybody that the depth of what he was writing was not going to fit into three books. Moradin is the original, if you will, bad guy. And it, just his evilness, he's not as evil as the Dark One, but maybe he's even a little more because he thinks he could be, or he could be better than the Dark One.
It's one of the things that always impressed me about Ishmael, is that he was a maverick. I mean, even in the Age of Legends, he was always, you know, pushing the boundaries of what could be seen or done or known. And I mean, he was a philosopher, and he wrote books, The Analysis of Perceived Meaning, Reality and the Absence of Meaning, and the Disassembly of Reason. And when everyone else was going during the break, or not the breaking, but during the Dark One breaking free, when everyone was like, oh my God, it's the end of the world, pestilences and plagues, Ishmael was like, no, it's the great Dark Lord breaking free. I call now for the casting down of all of the old order. We need the complete destruction of everything so we can rise up a new and, you know, greater society under the rule of our benevolent Dark God. And, you know, he legitimately believed what he was saying, and it was just kind of that, just out there, and this must be done, and this must be achieved. And then somewhere along the line, the thousands of years just kind of aided his brain enough to be like, not our great Dark God, because I am the great Dark God.
Yeah, that's a power trip for you.
Yeah, in the absence of the Dark One, he sort of becomes the Dark One. So you kind of wonder if the Dark One was not around, if he would not be the origin of the cycle.
But I actually find that his evolution into the character of Moradin to be almost more interesting. He still is obviously not quite sane, but he seems much more sane than his previous incarnation as Ishmael. He seems a lot more grounded, and focused, if you will. Well, that's just my perception.
Something that I'm just kind of contemplating while I'm been listening to all the good points you guys are making, and this may be totally in the realm of crazy theories, and obviously I'd need to do a little research on it to see if there's anything to support it, but I'm wondering, what if Moradin is not really Nablees? There's a particular line that keeps coming to mind when I'm thinking about this, and that is, well, if nobody is crazy enough to claim that they are one of the Forsaken, for example, if they're not, or that they would be Nablees if they were not. But we're talking about how completely crazy he is. Maybe he has just decided to, amongst himself, to become Nablees, and maybe that's what the Dark One is letting him play at it, because that's kind of how he wanted his minions to fight with each other, and whoever steps up and takes the power is going to get the power. So, just a thought there.
Well, he's obviously got some support from the Dark One, because he's interacting with Shaidar Haran, the Superfade, you know, who is the Hand of the Dark, and they're obviously working together on some things, so I would say that he's definitely got some sanction going on.
I would obviously agree that, yes, obviously he has the support of the Dark One in acting as Nablees, but I'm wondering how does somebody who was basically killed, brought back by the Dark One, and then put into a new body, all of the others who that's happened to seem to be coming back in really low-level positions, and he comes back and gets rewarded as being Nablees. And I'm wondering if maybe he just stepped up and decided to claim the right, and thus was granted the right.
No, but honestly, I don't think that's such a bad idea. I mean, maybe the Dark One truly didn't make him Nablees, but he's just taking it. And that assertion is what the Dark One is all about, is he's asserting himself to be something that he truly is not. Like, the Dark One believes that he is the creator, and he's not the creator. And maybe Moradin is asserting himself to be Nablees, but he really isn't.
Well, I think, to me, the difference is that Eshamiel was killed, but he didn't really fail. I mean, other than the fact that he got himself killed by Randall Thor, he didn't have some notable failure, which all of the other Forsaken that were killed and brought back seem to have had happen to them. And I think that Eshamiel was always probably one of the Dark One's favorites, and that's why he was brought back into an elevated position. I just don't think that he had messed up badly enough to be downgraded the way some of the others were. I mean, he really did a lot to try and move the evil Dark One's plans along through all those centuries, and he was actually even apparently able to touch the world in between the breaking, according to various cycles of time. And he was able to influence Artur Hawkwing and influence the creation of the Black Aja and, you know, various different times in history since the breaking. So I think that he got a lot of props for that, and that's why he didn't come back, you know, as a lower level Forsaken, but came back as Nablees.
If you think about the Dark One as a character, I don't think he would be really that much different than Eshamiel, would he?
No, that's probably why.
No, I would have to agree. I don't think he would be.
That's probably why he considered him one of his favorites, I think.
The other thing, and I mean, you did kind of, this was kind of pointed out a little earlier, it would be kind of interesting, because we know the cycle has to continue. If during the last battle, if the Dark One is disposed of, if Eshamiel, Moradin, whatever you want to call him, already believing himself to be the Dark One, might not just go ahead and step up and claim that title too, and actually become the new Dark One within the new cycle.
That's not actually entirely half bad a theory.
No, I was going to agree. I think that's sort of the nature of evil. And we've seen this in various other fantasy series, probably most notably Star Wars. The higher somebody ascends along the ladder of evil, there can only really be one at the top. And the very nature of them being in a hierarchy of evil means that the person that ascends to the top, whether it becomes Nablees or the Dark One himself, it's always going to be living in fear of the next greatest apprentice coming along and doing them in. That's how they advance.
Okay, final thoughts on Eshamiel.
He's creepy.
Slash Morden.
Yeah, I agree with Virginia. Very creepy.
Beware of the hand that moves the Fisher Canyon.
That whole scene was really creepy, and I thought that was very revealing, and I really don't think that... I probably need to read it again. I really don't think that I have gleaned all I could from that scene, because there was that very powerful statement about it was very hard to lose when you played both sides of the game against each other, and you were moving all the pieces, and that he said specifically in his mind that Randall Thor was already moving according to his direction. And he's already interfered with him, because we believe that he's the one that saved him as the Wanderer in Shadar Logoth when he defeated Samael.
Thank you, Andrew, so much for bringing that up, because that's one of my absolute... As a chess player, I wouldn't say avid, but I would say probably middle-of-the-road chess player. That was one of my absolute favorite scenes of the whole book. The fact that Morden is truly playing both sides of the board, and that speaks to truly his arrogance. His arrogance as being very akin to the Dark One's arrogance.
Well, and there's also the fact that we've got this new connection where Rand and Morden can basically become aware of each other at some points in time, sort of like the swirling colors phenomenon that Rand, Matt, and Perrin have had now. Rand is not only seeing Luz Theron's face, but he's seeing Morden, and there's one point in time where he distinctly knows that he's aware of the other person is aware of him, that Morden is actually aware of him. So I think that there's going to be, this is my crazy theory, I think there's going to be a merge there at some point in time between Luz Theron, Morden, and Rand. And one will live and the other two will not, or something. Or Luz Theron will go to be among the heroes of the Horn, and Morden will die and Rand will live, or something of that nature. I think there's something going on there. There's a real connection.
With that said, thank you, Virginia. We are going to wrap up this episode, this specific episode of The Forsaken, because we're in talk time. We're running at about 2.5 hours, so we'll see how much it gets to edit time. But next time, our next episode, we will be speaking of Lanfear, Messana, Mogideon, Ravine, Samael, and Semirhag. So we have 6 Forsaken left out of the 13. We've covered 7 this evening. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Wheel of Time podcast. We are not going to specifically close out the Fourth Age this week, because we're going to continue the Forsaken next week. So...
Well, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking about The Forsaken with all of you. I am going to make every possible effort to attend next week, but I will be traveling for work, and it will all depend on connectivity from my hotel room. So I will try very hard, and if I don't make it to next week's podcast, then you guys enjoy discussing the rest of The Forsaken. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, in lieu of our usual ending, since we aren't closing the podcast off, I would just like to say, from my own perspective of having been gone for quite a bit, and that it's definitely good to be back, and I will see you all next week.
It's been fun. This is one of my favorite topics. I think we could probably do 2 or 3 episodes on The Forsaken if we didn't limit ourselves, but I'm glad that you were able to join us, and we'll see you next week with the rest of The Forsaken.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and just to recap our contact information, please email podcast@dragonmount.com, or each of us individually have our own email addresses at dragonmount.com. I also want to take a special little second or two to thank everybody who talks to me on World of Warcraft, as geeky as it is. I do get a lot of whispers during my playing time of people that listen to our podcast, and I appreciate it. I'm on the server Guldan, G-U-L-D-A-N. I have 2 names. My first name is Kinslayer, which is a fantastic name, if anybody can agree. And my second name is my favorite Forsaken, which is Grendahl. Thank everybody who contacts me on World of Warcraft. I'll give you gold if you contact me, I promise. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is the Fourth Age Podcast, and we appreciate it. Please email us at podcast@dragonmount.com if you have any questions, any comments, anything that you want to be put into the show. We'll mention your name. We are also working on the Memorial Podcast as well for Robert Jordan's death, everybody that had put in their voicemails to our 888 number, we are working on it. We're just working through some music difficulties. We have some music that we want to put on the podcast, but we're trying to get the rights and whatnot to put on there. So that's taken a little more time than what I thought it would, but we'll get it out within, I'm going to say, within the next 2 to 3 weeks. So thank everybody for listening.
And you mentioned that 888 number. It is still active if you want to call in and leave us a message. The number is 1-888-333-7690.
And we also have our MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage. Please do send us a voicemail. We'd love to hear from you. We'd like to play your comments on the air. And once again, thank you so much for listening. This is Virginia saying goodbye for now.
And this is Jason saying goodbye. I'll see you next time.
And of course, for everyone here at the Fourth Age, Serapia Ninto, Manshima, Tai Shite.
May the light illumine you.